Thank you very much to the Philadelphia Society for the invitation and the opportunity to speak here. It's a pleasure to speak before such an august body and before such an impressive and somewhat eclectic panel. We've had a moderator who makes an intelligent apologetic for Glenn Beck, a professor who makes a case for kind of economic fact versus economic flimflam, you know, somebody who's doing important activism to help courageous people do important work. And now I'm a wonk from Washington, and I'm going to kind of make an amusing historical parallel. We'll see if maybe in the Q&A we can tie together the various strands of this. I want to make an argument about the political communication moment that we are in right now. For the past decade, we've been watching a transformation in the nature of political communication, specifically the blogosphere, which is sort of the third step in really three decades of a transformation in political communication. The rise, starting in the 1980s, of talk radio, the rise starting in the late 1990s of cable news, and then in the last decade, the rise of the blogosphere. 20 years ago, the World Wide Web was just being invented. 15 years ago, millions of people were for the first time encountering the World Wide Web. 10 years ago, blogging was invented. The software that powers blogging really came into being, and soon after that, blogging was derided. It was mocked by the professionals of the world of political communication and journalism. Prominent editor at one of the Newsweekly magazines called bloggers, those people, I may be getting the wording a little bit wrong, but those people who live in their mother's basements wearing pajamas. Now, we live in a very different moment now, when all the major media outlets are hiring bloggers of their own or making their in-house staffers blog, and we're seeing a transformation in the actual facts of American political life, thanks in part to blogging, because blogging has empowered, it's facilitated, to use all these kind of empty words, the Tea Party movement, the social networking technology and blogging technology that the last decade has given rise to, have been really essential to the Tea Party movement that is at the moment just shaking up American politics. So I want to take a page out of what the Tea Party does and out of what Glenn Beck does and look to the founders to try to understand this particular moment in political communication. And I want to propose that we might understand it by drawing out some of the similarities between the past decade and another decade, one of the founders' decades, 1790s, and the rise during the 1790s of, in particular, a partisan press. Now, most of you are probably already familiar with the politics of the 1790s, you'll forgive me for what will be a very kind of whirlwind, kind of cursory tour of just the role of the press in the 1790s and the state of American politics in that era. But the 1790s certainly didn't see the first newspapers in America. The first newspaper in America actually came a century earlier in 1690. The first interesting newspaper was the one that Ben Franklin put out. But that wasn't a particularly political news outlet at all. It had amusing stories and some news items, but it wasn't affiliated with a particular political movement. That started to shift. Newspapers started to become more overtly aligned with political movements. In the years following the Revolution, when the Revolution started, there were 38 newspapers in the country. The largest of them had a circulation of about 2,500, and probably the most important was the one that Sam Adams worked for up in Boston, that fire-breathing genius of instigation. And by the year 1790, sort of the start of the constitutional era of government, by 1790 there were 92 newspapers in the country, And they played a central role for the first time, really, in partisan politics. Now, when we think about politics in the 1790s, we think about the two familiar parties that arose kind of cracking up the Washington administration, right? The Democratic Republicans, sort of around in orbit around Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Jefferson at this point being the Secretary of State in the Washington administration, and then the Federalist Party that was the pro-government party and orbited more or less around Alexander Hamilton. And it's important to recognize that the papers of that era, the newspapers of that era, rapidly fell into camps that matched more or less precisely the two extant parties. So there were overtly, explicitly Federalist papers and explicitly Democratic, Republican, Jeffersonian papers. Noah Webster, for instance, whom we all know for, you know, his spelling guide, his dictionary, his role in education, he was actually the editor of one of the more prominent Federalist papers. And there was a guy, Benjamin Franklin Bakke, actually, who was the grandson of Ben Franklin, who was the publisher, the editor of the Philadelphia Aurora, a newspaper that so scandalized George Washington that it made essentially, it made holding the office of the presidency intolerable for him. Now, these papers weren't just reporting, they weren't just covering the news, they actually were the news. The editors of these papers weren't simply, figures who were just kind of watching and editorializing on what was happening. They were themselves political figures. And the debate in which they were engaged was not just about politics, it was itself the heart of American politics in the 1790s. And when I say that they were aligned with the two parties, I mean they were literally almost party organs. So for instance, the Federalists in 1789, the year that the constitutional government kicked off and Washington became president, the Federalists started a paper called the Gazette of the United States. Hamilton himself hired a guy named John Fenno, who would edit this thing, and Hamilton wrote for him. Hamilton would leave his job, leave work, and then spend hours at night in Fenno's print shop writing things out. Fenno and his crew would be typesetting the stuff that Hamilton had just scribbled out, and Hamilton would churn out these multi-thousand word things overnight that the next day, with astonishing rapidity, would be published and would be infuriating Thomas Jefferson, who was so astonished by the energy of Hamilton that he called him a host unto himself. Hamilton also actually arranged to give money, to funnel money to Fenno and his newspaper. Being Secretary of the Treasury, you could do that sort of thing. He directed all the advertising dollars that the Treasury Department had to Fenno's newspaper. And that's pretty bad, right? We wouldn't see that happen today. Well, you actually do, as we'll see in a moment, with the world of bloggers. But the Jeffersonians were doing the same thing. Jefferson and Madison, angered that the Gazette run by Fenno had been really kicking them around for a couple years, in 1791 started their own Gazette, the National Gazette, this time edited by a guy named Philip Freneau, who was Madison's roommate in college at Princeton, and who was an accomplished poet. And he actually didn't have Jefferson or Madison actually writing anything for him. Well, Madison a little bit, not Jefferson. Jefferson did something else. Jefferson actually gave him his office key so that at night, Freneau could actually sneak into Jefferson's office, rifle through the papers that Jefferson intentionally left out on his desk so that he could then print excerpts of them before the president had even seen these papers. So Jefferson was a master of the leak, and Jefferson had this guy, Freneau, on the payroll of the State Department. The guy was actually working formally in the State Department. So what I'd like to draw out now is a set of eight similarities between the media moment of the 1790s and the media moment that we're in now. So those of you who are taking notes, I promise you there'll be eight, and you can hold me to that. Some of these are a little more facile than others. Some are a little more serious. So the first, you know, probably the most obvious parallel between what you see in the 1790s and what you've seen in the last decade is just the proliferation and the number of media outlets. We have had who in this room has ever blogged in any way? Just raise your hand. Have you ever? Yeah, exactly. Millions of people have blogged. And there have been millions of blogs, just created. In the period of the 1790s, there were 92 newspapers, as I said, in 1790. By the year 1800, there were 234, including 24 daily newspapers, which is an astonishing output, frankly, in a country this size. And it's worth remarking that in both cases, this wasn't just an increase in the number. This was creative destruction. I mean, it ended up with 234, but over that time period, there were some 350 newspapers that had existed, just as there were many more millions of blogs that existed briefly and don't anymore. So I think point one would be the kind of proliferation of blogs and of newspapers in the 1790s. Point two would be the role of participation. In the past decade, we've seen blogs as an especially participatory medium with millions of people, including all of you whose hands were up, and the rest of you probably at least commenting or reading blogs. So there's a kind of universality of involvement, and you get something very similar during the 1790s with hundreds of thousands of people having access to the news that appears in newspapers, if not through their own subscriptions, then in the taverns where they read them, comment on them, debate them, and write letters that are published constantly. It's an enormous kind of level of involvement, democratic involvement in political communication. Point number three, similarity number three, we think of blogging as a technical innovation. Well, it's worth remembering that the rise of the partisan popular press in the United States in the 1790s was also inspired by technological innovations, including better paper, we had started making paper only after the revolution here in this country. We had imported paper before the revolution. More presses, more advanced presses, new techniques for, thanks to the Postal Service, for transporting the news around much more quickly, and even a kind of invention of a sort of division of labor, so that when Ben Franklin was a young man, we all picture him in the print shop wearing the kind of printer's apron. He was not just writing stuff, but actually doing the work of printing. In the 1790s, those jobs are utterly separated. So you've got the guys whose ink-stained fingers, they're the ones doing the writing, then you got the other people who are just totally covered in ink, who are doing the actual printing work. So that was number three. Number four, parallel number four is the rise of kind of pseudonymity, right? We know that bloggers love, and commenters on blogs love to either write pseudonymously or anonymously, and I think this is one of the more obvious points. We all know about the love of pseudonyms, especially derived from classical names of the founding era. We all know about Publius and Pacificus and Candidus and Americanus. And my favorite actually is one of the pseudonyms that Sam Adams used a little earlier than this, which was Vindex the Avenger, which sounds like a kind of cleaning fluid that gets very angry. So that was number four. Number five is something called fisking. If you know anything about blogging, you've heard of fisking. This is to reproduce an entire blog post on your own site or an entire news article on your own site just so that you can line by line dissect it and brutally dismantle the argument that the author of the original post or article made. Well, this is not new. This happened in the 1790s. I told you there was this Jeffersonian Gazette and the Federalist Gazette. They would do this, starting at least as early as December 1792. They would reprint one another's articles in their entirety just so that they could cut them up, snip them into pieces, and kind of slather on sarcasm and snark in a mode that's really very reminiscent of what we see in the blogosphere today. Similarity number six is that people were paid by the parties to write. I mentioned how that happened in the 1790s. It's happening today. Not all bloggers, certainly, but there are many bloggers, a goodly number, anyway, of bloggers who are actually getting small amounts of money, nothing big, but from party organizations and directly from candidates. Point number seven, I would say there's a very noticeable similarity in rhetorical style. If you know anything about the newspapers of the 1790s, if you know anything about the debates of the 1790s, you know that they were vicious. And if you know anything about debates in the blogosphere, you know that they too can be vicious. In both cases, there is a kind of no-holds-barred, name-calling, trash-talking, scoop-chasing, insult-leveling, leak-printing, rumor-floating, kind of gutter-sniping, gossip-peddling, scandal-mongering. It just celebrity-bashing, muckraking, mudslinging. It's wonderful. And these kind of slurs and snipes and slander that characterize the conversation in the blogosphere today, that was all over in the 1790s. They did it better than we did, because they did it with classical allusions and lewd poetry. Point number eight I'll get to in just a moment. How am I doing on time? A little bit of time. Okay. Let me just dwell for just a moment on George Washington. I said a little bit about him earlier. As the target of so much of the venom that was being spat and the mud that was being slung, Washington, he took very personally and got very angry at a lot of this in a way that he didn't really get angry at much else. Washington was known for his reservoirs of self-control. But the three or four of the times that we know of after the end of the revolution that he actually became furious and yelled or just flipped out, frankly, were as the result of these papers that were calling him cowardly, desirous of kingship, insipid, a demigod of a Turkish seraglio. And they excoriated his policies too. And Philip Freneau, the Jeffersonian publisher, sent three copies to Washington's house every day of his Gazette. I mean, that's moxie. That's chutzpah right there. I mean, this guy's serious. So now Washington actually wrote in the draft of his farewell address, there was a passage about the newspapers and how much he hated them. Some of the Gazettes, he wrote, have teemed with all the invective that disappointment, ignorance of facts, and malicious falsehood could invent to misrepresent my politics and affections, to wound my reputation and feelings, and to weaken, if not entirely destroy, the confidence you, the people who would be reading the farewell address, you had been pleased to repose in me. It might be expected, at the parting score of my public life, that I should take some notice of such a virulent abuse. But, this is my favorite part, but, he says, after this whole, rant, but, as heretofore, I shall pass them over in utter silence. Hamilton, editing this, wisely cut it out, because Hamilton understood that nobody likes a whiner. What did famously make it into Washington's farewell address, of course, is his indictment of parties. If you know the farewell address, you know he talks about the danger of parties and the baneful effects of the spirit of party and, the common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of party. And that wasn't just Washington. As Gordon Wood wrote in his most recent book, Americans at this time, certainly at the start of the Washington administration, were universally hostile to the idea of parties. But in the 1790s, they created them. They were impelled by principle and by personal animosity, that too, but they were impelled to create these things that they loathed. That they actually created the structure and the functioning and the institutions of working, functioning parties. Now, this is so often depicted as a kind of lamentable thing, right? The greatest biographer of Washington titled the last volume of his biography, Anguish and Farewell, because this was a period of anguish for Washington. And every 4 years, whenever there's a negative ad during a presidential campaign, they always trot out, you know, the worst hits of the 1790s. You think political campaigning is bad now? Well, look at what they did back then. But it seems to me that we should actually celebrate what they did in the 1790s as a kind of positive achievement, the creation of this party system. And this is where I would draw as the eighth parallel of the eight that I promised, because just as Americans in the 1790s really kind of turned into a very partisan state of politics and created a kind of partisan press, so too, over the course of the past decade, have we seen, for the first time in 80 years, a return to an outright, open, partisan press. We've got not just talk radio, but we've got Fox News and MSNBC. Fox News doesn't even pretend anymore that it's fair and balanced, right? It doesn't say that. They're just, okay, we don't need to say it anymore. People understand Fox is conservative, MSNBC is liberal. We've got all the talk radio stations. We've got bloggers who are just getting out there and saying what they're saying. This comes on the heels of really 80 years of kind of quashing political dissent. When you think about, not political dissent, kind of quashing a party. I'm going to wrap up right now. I'm getting the little flag. But let me just end by saying Professor Lord earlier talked about the empirical nature of the press for most of the last several decades. And I'd add that it's not simply empirical, but you see these two kind of fundamental convictions that animate the press for the last 80 years. One of them is this kind of idealistic crusading notion. You've all heard about this idea of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, right? This precedes the progressive movement, but really reaches its peak there and has animated so much of the kind of lefty media that we all in this room love to despise. But at the same time, there's this kind of what Richard Weaver in the Ethics of Rhetoric calls a kind of pose of impartiality that they like to take. And these two things are fundamentally in conflict with one another. And what we've seen now over the course of the last decade is a walk away from that kind of, we're above politics, and a return at last to an acknowledgement that we can actually debate fundamental questions. So I would just end for now. And I'd welcome questions about, say, the Sedition Act or something like that later. But I would just end for now by saying the return to talking openly, speaking openly about fundamental political questions is frankly necessary for the preservation of liberty, for the protection and preservation of human dignity, and for the investigation of natural law. Really, to understand the deepest questions of our political affairs, we need to confront politics openly. And in the 1790s, they started to do that, and started to do that again, and so have we now in the past decade. Thank you very much.